Good evening, everyone, and welcome once again to the Monterey Conference Center in beautiful Monterey by the Bay for the third event in the 18th annual Leon Panetta Lecture Series. It's been 18 years, folks. Our theme this year, as you know, is critical issues that can unite or divide America. It's been discussed through the topics of energy for the first event, race relations for the second event, and now I know from many phone calls and emails and letters that we've received and the conversations that I've had with audience members like you and those who are watching on television and on the internet, how much these lectures have prompted discussion, have prompted a desire to learn more, and have prompted greater understanding of these critical issues. Tonight, we turn our focus to the economy to see what new ideas and insights arise from our consideration of this vital issue. Recent statistics show that the American middle class is shrinking. What does this mean for our economy and for our democracy? Is this disparity the result of globalization and technological changes? Was the Great Recession the cause of lost jobs and stagnant wages? What role has the growing national debt played in our economy? Does expanding trade help or hurt our economy and jobs? As we consider the state of Wall Street and Main Street, are we protected from future economic threats? Have we taken the steps we need to ensure transparency and stability in our financial institutions? Is there a way to approach the economy that protects equal economic opportunity for all while still preserving the spirit of free enterprise that has made our nation an economic leader for so long? Are there solutions to be found in improving education and job training? What about tax reform and restructuring entitlements? Tonight, Leon will pose these questions and many more to some of the most respected economic experts of our time. Our first guest is internationally recognized for his research on economic growth, tax and budget theory and policy, saving and consumption patterns, and the implications of changing technology and demography on capital, labor, and product markets. He served as chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors during the administration of George H.W. Bush. He then went on to chair the Congressional Advisory Commission on the Consumer Price Index, where the report his commission produced was credited with transforming the way government agencies across the globe measure inflation, GDP, and productivity. Please welcome Michael Boskin. Our second guest is a returning favorite of the lecture series. He is the former U.S. Secretary of Labor and served on President Barack Obama's Economic Transition Team. He is the author of 15 books, and to name some, Supercapitalism, which warned of the perils of an underregulated and overleveraged financial system, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future, and Beyond Outrage, which talks about what has gone wrong with our economy and our democracy and how to fix it. His forthcoming book, Saving Capitalism, examines the building blocks of the American economy and explores methods of preserving growth while spreading benefits. Please welcome Robert Reich. Welcome. Yes, we have. Our third guest is best known for her work on the causes of the Great Depression, the subsequent recovery, and the conduct and consequences of monetary and fiscal policy. She has also researched the impact of economic growth and inflation and the effects of tax cuts on private investment and government spending. As chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisors in the administration of Barack Obama, she helped guide the administration's response to the economic crisis and played a key role in macroeconomic policy, rescue and reform of the financial system, healthcare reform, and budget policy. Please welcome Christina Romer. Welcome. It's nice to have you. Our final guest is one of our most popular returning speakers and a wise and witty U.S. Senator from Wyoming. He served in the Senate for three terms and was Assistant Majority Leader for a decade. Leon and he served together on the Iraq Study Group. And in 2010, President Obama selected him to co-chair the bipartisan National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, better known as the Simpson-Bowles Commission. Since the release of the commission's final report in 2010, he has been an outspoken critic of the failure of the two political parties to work together and agree on measures to reduce the deficit and govern the nation. Please welcome Alan Simpson. Welcome.
Creeping up.
A lot better this time. There we go, Ron. Better hitch up my pants here.
Moderating the discussion is the man who created this lecture series 18 years ago, the chairman of the Panetta Institute, former director of the CIA, and former Secretary of Defense. The economy is an issue he knows well from his time as chairman of the House Budget Committee, his time as director of the Office of Management and Budget, and more recently as Secretary of Defense when he had to deal with the impact of the sequester. Please welcome Secretary Leon E. Panetta. I love you.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this, the third forum of our lecture series. As you know, our theme is the test of leadership in 2015, critical issues that can unite or divide America. The first forum we had talked about energy. Second forum, we talked about race relations. We are already embarked on a presidential election. And if elections are decided by pocketbook issues, and I believe that they largely are, then perhaps the most critical issue that we should be talking about is our economy. My immigrant parents came to this country, like millions of others, with little money in their pocket and few skills. But they came in search of the American dream, and knew that if they worked hard and they sacrificed, that ultimately they would become part of that broad middle class in this country that could enjoy the opportunities available in this great country. There is some question today as to whether or not that American dream will be available to our children, whether they'll be able to enjoy the same opportunity. And I think the reason that there's a question is that there is a gap that has developed in our society, recognized by both Democrats and Republicans, a gap that has resulted in shrinking that middle class, which was always important not only to our economy, but to our democracy. You know the numbers. We're looking at a situation now where the top 5% hold 65% of the wealth in this country. The lower one half of wage earners hold about 1% of the wealth in this country. Those at the upper income level are earning 70 times more than those at lower income levels. Of course, there have always been differences between the wealthy and others in the society. We always embrace the hope that we too can move up in that scale. But the problem we're facing now is that what is happening is that the gap is reducing the middle class perhaps to its lowest point in more than 30 years, some say, not since 1928 have we seen the size of this gap. So I think it was important with these four distinguished speakers to kind of start off with a key question, which is, why is the middle class being squeezed in this country? And what is it we can do in order to restore a strong middle class to America? Michael?
Well, Leon, it's great to be here. Let's all congratulate Leon and Sylvia for this forum, and I want to just repeat that. I honor Christy and Bob's service. We occasionally disagree on some aspects of policy, sometimes in nuance, sometimes more fundamentally. Alan Ann Simpson, like Leon and Sylvia, are jewels that you find when you're in Washington that let you weather the nonsense you have to put up to do public service these days. So they're just great people, and I'm honored to be on a panel with these distinguished people. First of all, it's important to understand that the increase in inequality and the relative stagnation, I think properly measured, they've been growing slowly, not declining or stagnant, but they're growing very slowly, much more slowly than they used to be, is a global phenomenon. It's happening in all the all the major economies, and therefore there must be some general global causes that are the primary cause of this. It can't be just something that's specific to the U.S. Now, the U.S. is a less equal society than France or Germany and many others, not as unequal as Brazil, but it's unequal. So what are those forces? And pretty clearly, the two large ones are technology and globalization. China started opening its economy to a, quote, socialist market economy, or their version of some form of capitalism, around 1978, when Deng Xiaoping made his southern tour. Then we had the collapse of the former USSR and their whole interaction with their, what we used to call satellites, although President Ford got in trouble for calling them that. And then Rajiv Gandhi did some reforms in the early 90s in India. This has added hundreds of millions of people to the global labor force able to produce traded goods and commodities. And that has put, and continues to put, downward pressure on the earnings of all but the most highly educated and skilled workers in the advanced economies. There are other factors, some that are American specific. I'm sure the other panelists mentioned, so I want to just be brief. I think the main problem isn't inequality per se. That's the manifestation primarily of stagnant growth of earnings for the broad population, and that our main problem is to enhance economic growth. President Kennedy exaggerated a bit when he said a rising tide lifts all boats, but it sure lifts a hell of a lot more than any other tide, and it leaves far fewer sunk or stranded. Bob will call them yachts, but that's another story. So we need to get our policy straight, because the foundation of it all has to be economic growth. There are things we have to do to complement that in our education system, in provision of certain services, in our a more efficient but humane social safety net, all those kinds of things that we'll have plenty of time to talk about. But the prime message I want to get across is this is a global phenomenon. We need stronger growth. From the end of World War II, from 1948 till just before the Great Recession, the U.S. economy averaged 3.2% growth a year. That's averaged over booms and busts and average times. And we haven't had three consecutive quarters of 3% growth in a decade. So we have a big growth gap that is part of the reason we had high unemployment for a while, part of the reason wages haven't risen. We're going to have to get growth up. There are many aspects to that, both on the demand and supply side, but let me stop and let the others talk about it.
Bob?
There's much I agree with that Michael just said. Certainly, every major economy is subjected to the same forces of globalization and technology and technological change. And we talk about globalization a lot. You hear the word all the time. Rarely has a word in our common discussions gone from so directly from obscurity to meaninglessness without any intervening period of coherence. I mean, basically, when we talk about globalization, we're talking not just about trade, but about integration of global economies through direct investment, through immigration is to a large extent. And undoubtedly, Michael is right. You've got these two forces. But the interesting thing with the United States is the United States is the outlier in terms of inequality among all advanced nations. We are the most unequal. And the question is, how is it that these other nations, facing the same degrees of globalization and technological change, have managed to fight back against inequality, and we have succumbed as much as we have to it? And I think a lot of it has to do with two factors. They're not the only factors, but one factor has to be, because these other nations have stronger trade unions, labor unions. In the United States, if you go back to 1955, 35% of the private sector workforce in this country was unionized, which gave American workers the bargaining leverage they needed to get a substantial share of the gains from economic growth. Now, only in the private sector, less than 7% of workers are unionized. So there's very little bargaining leverage left. The second factor is education, and Michael mentioned this, but if you look at other advanced nations, they are not only spending more, but they're spending it better on education. We tend not to. In fact, so much of our primary and secondary education in this country is based on local property taxes, and we're segregating by income more than we've ever segregated before. So as a result, among all advanced nations, the United States is one of the very few that spends less per pupil on poor kids than we do per pupil on wealthy kids. It's not that we intended it that way, it's just the way we have decided to segregate by income into different townships and different cities. So I think, Leon, again, there's no easy cure, there's no easy answer, there are many other factors at play here, but I think that political decisions or failure to make the right political decisions have got to be part of the picture.
Christine?
Well, I'd like to start again by thanking everyone for being here and being how delighted I am to be on this panel and to come back to where you started, because I really think you framed it correctly as that the real issue is what's happening to that ordinary family. And that's where we have seen stagnation in, you know, the income of the ordinary family, actually in real terms gone down a little bit in recent years. And so thinking about what's behind that, inequality is a part of the story, because what growth we have has been going up to the top of the income distribution. But there are other factors. Michael's absolutely right that overall growth, sort of technological progress, just how fast are we coming up with new ideas, new inventions, and that has slowed down. And it was that really fast growth after World War II that was a big part of why we were able to see ordinary families have a real improvement in their income. And then the other sort of piece of the diagnosis, I think you have to put a role to what's happening with the labor force. We have actually been seeing, you know, whereas the 70s, the story of the 70s was a lot of women coming into the labor force, the story of the last 15 years, and especially since the terrible recession, has been a lot of people dropping out of the labor force. And some of that is people hitting retirement age, but a frighteningly large part of it is prime age workers just either getting discouraged and leaving the labor force or going out for some other reason. And that's taking a toll on what happens to the income for a typical family. So if you think of that as kind of the diagnosis, then what do you do about it? And you know, I think there are lots of things. I think there's an important role for public policy. I mean, in some ways, right, invention, that's our bright students that we got to meet with earlier today. That's the capitalist system. That can be good for invention, but there are ways that government can help, whether it's investing in basic science, it's investing in infrastructure. I think those things could be helpful for getting growth up. If you think some of the problem is the labor force, there are ways that we can try to bring people back into the labor force, maybe make it more flexible so parents don't feel the same either, you know, yes or no to the labor force, but more able to balance things. Or maybe older workers would be happy to work part-time but not full-time, and thinking about that kind of flexibility, I think, is important. And then inequality is absolutely something we need to deal with. Bob talked about some ways, but there are others. We have a tax system, and one of the things you can use your tax system to do is to raise more revenue at the top of the income distribution and use that to expand either education programs to give everyone an equal footing. You can expand the earned income tax credit to try to help people at the very bottom of the income distribution who are working hard, struggling to try to get ahead. So I think that should be on the table as well, and I'm sure we'll probably discuss that as time goes on. But it's a big issue, not surprisingly, with lots of causes and lots of possible solutions.
Alan?
First, thank you, and Sylvia. It's a wonderful program. I've been privileged to do it. That's called phlegm there. That's a cowboy said, you got a little phlegm in your throat there. Actually, it's called phlegm, I think, but whatever it is, it ain't worth a damn. But now, back now people will begin to call. While he's out gallivanting around, Sylvia made this place work, and she is amazing. And go to her. You just hit upon something that was so really puzzling to Erskine Bowles and I in our work. We worked for eight months. There were 18 of us. We got five Democrats, five Republicans, one independent, that's a majority of the group, to vote for a 67-page report which hit everybody. Everybody ran from it, everybody. Don't blame the president or the House or the Senate or the leadership, because we dinged everybody, and it's not a good thing to do, but we did. And then you say, people will say, well, who was on the commission? Well, I said, Durbin voted for it. Durbin, isn't that guy from Illinois, that commie guy? No. Well, Coburn voted for it. Coburn, that Republican from Oklahoma, for God's, that's your country right now. You just identify somebody of the other party and you nail them. You stereotype them. These guys both work beautifully. But what we found was grotesque. And it's something that you don't even know about, except you know about every part in it, but you don't know it's called a tax expenditure. Came into the books sometime in 1960 by some wizard in the Treasury who figured, how do we get this kind of money out of the system and people know it's not a tax increase? Well, I tell you, all I can tell you, it's over 180 of them, and they take $100 billion out of the Treasury, which is exactly the amount of income that came in 2011 from individual returns. What are they? Oh, home mortgage interest deduction, employer deduction, employee health care, oil and gas depletion allowance, parking for employees, Blue Cross, Blue Shield insurance, shot through by special interests who put municipal bond. I can leave everybody in this room limp. Okay, and Erskine and I said, we'll get rid of them all. Just zero it out and give everybody from zero to 70,000 bucks, you pay 8%. From 70 to 210, you pay 14. Everything over that, you pay 23. And take the corporate rate from 36 to 26 and go to a territorial system so you don't tax it twice. Everybody fainted. And they all talk about what they want to do, broaden the tax base, you know, fix the rates. We did. And I can tell you, only 20% of the American people use 80% of the stuff in the code. And who are those people? That's everybody in this room. Get your hand way up. Because everyone in this room is using one of those 180 plus gimmicks that suck money directly out of the Treasury. I'm good at it. I have an accountant. You do too. You can't do it yourself anymore. And so there it is. And what are we doing about it? Nothing. They talk about tax reform. Every time they open the box, here comes the realtors. I happen to sleep with one. I sleep with a realtor for 60 years I've been sleeping with that person.
With the same realtor.
It's the same realtor. Yes. We don't believe in duplex in our office. I married a twin, too, and they said, how do you tell them apart? I said, I never considered that my responsibility. but nevertheless. So just to tell you the reaction we had from the realtors on that, they said, God, you can't waive this $1 million, interest tax reduction. I say, well, yeah, what's $1 million to most guys? So we said, give everybody a 12.5% non-refundable tax credit, which helps the little guy that everybody talks about day and night in this game. Don't forget the game is played about the little guy and the poor and this and this. Well, when you have a situation like that, when only 25% of the people itemize and the other 75 haven't even heard of the stuff in the tax code, you got inequality, deluxe.
Let me ask you, let me ask all of you, do we have to make a choice here between growth and redistribution? Because there is this debate about what should be done. Democrats are arguing that, many Democrats are arguing that we need to obviously increase taxes, carbon tax, et cetera, develop greater programs to assist those that are in trouble, as well as increase regulation to try to deal with market problems. And then, Republicans, I think Michael touched on this, have been arguing that growth is a better key to trying to deal with the issue of how do we restore the middle class, and that Democrats think that we've ended growth in this country and that we now have to divide up the pie. What is it? What do we have to do to be able to get it done?
I think to some extent, Leon, that's a false distinction. Okay. Because the way we get growth back is we have a large and vital middle class. That is, we can't get growth back unless the middle class has enough purchasing power to keep the economy going. 70% of the economy is based upon consumer purchases. And as long as the lion's share of the economic gains are going to the very top, that middle class is shrinking. So we have an inherent economic problem in terms of growth because of the lack of a vibrant and growing middle class.
I would disagree with that. I think that Bob's analysis has some validity in a deep recession temporarily. But in the long run, saving and investment drives productivity growth, which is the heart of improving living standards. And if you look over long spans of time, over many countries, that's what's correlated with earnings or broad-based labor compensation, including fringe benefits and so on. So I do agree that both of these are problems. And I do agree we shouldn't be impervious to people hurting or to widespread inequality and lots of people falling short of their aspirations or not having opportunity. We ought to be addressing those things. But to suggest that we can do all the social engineering you want about the income distribution and have no ramification for slower growth, we can raise taxes as much as we want on the most productive people and the most successful small businesses in the country. We can have a lot of extra regulation. Well, it turns out capital is pretty mobile, and it'll move from locale to locale or from country to country as it is seeking its highest after-tax return. Now, not just taxes, there are many other things, not just looking for the lowest regulation. They want an educated workforce, they want to be close to their customers. So there's a lot of things going on here. One of the things that it's not popular to talk about, but I think most economists who have studied this would suggest that the single best thing we could do in the single best policy reform, it's far from sufficient and far from something that's likely to have a large impact on the distribution of income, is our corporate taxation has gotten way out of line with the other economies of the world. We're 50%, our corporate tax rate's 50% over the OECD average. When you allow for deductions and depreciation and stuff, it's not as far out of line, but that's become a big problem. Predecessors of Christie and myself for Kennedy and Johnson, Art Oken, in his memoir said the most effective thing in the Kennedy tax cuts was the corporate rate cuts. Now, I'm not saying it's the only thing we should do or the tax reform is the only thing. We need more people and much more economic activity paying taxes, contributing to the pie, and we have some public investments we need to make, some of which probably have been shortchanged in these difficult budgetary times. But we ought to focus on programs that work, not just on spending money. We ought to focus on the outcomes, not just calculating the outcome by how much we spend, how much is input.
Christy?
I actually want to disagree with Michael. So. you know, I think that a lot of these things are win-win. So Michael and I have had fights before about if you raise taxes on higher income people, how much is that going to cut back on effort and sort of productivity and things. And my read of the evidence is just not very much at all. So I think there are things that we can do that would actually improve equality, improve the standards of living for average families, and make us more productive. The classic win-win is education. That basically hits all my three reasons for why our middle-class income stagnating. More educated people are likely to be in the labor force. If you're more educated, that's going to help you get a higher piece of the pie, so that's going to help with inequality, and it's good for economic growth. Any firm will tell you what they want are skilled workers and educated workers. So that's just a classic way that we can, as a society, invest. My other one I think a lot about is basic science, right? So there's a lot of R&D that private industry will do because they can see an idea, they can patent it, they can make money on it. Nobody can make money on basic science, right? That's just one of these, you know, cool ideas of physics out there, and someday it will turn into a laser, and someday that will turn into something that you can actually sell, but that link is very hard. And so there's a kind of investment that's only going to be done by the public sector, but it is some of the most important investment we could do, and that is in basic medicine, basic science, and that, I think, is a place where we have been cutting back, and that's just like eating your seed corn in terms of your long-run growth. So that's an example of something that we could do that's good for standards of living, good for all the things we care about, and would be a win-win.
Well, you know, Alan, let me ask you. I mean, I understand these arguments, and I think, you know, the reality is that I think you can have both. I really do. I mean, to a large extent, what we did in the budgets, particularly, I mean, you know, Bush passed a budget for Bush 1 that actually addressed the deficit issue, got about $500 billion in deficit reduction. And Clinton did the same thing. Bob and I spent hours working on his budgets.
I was 6 foot one when we started. It took a lot out of me.
He was only 7 on the cuts.
But one of the things we did that I was proud of was that, you know, we addressed the entitlements. We got savings out of the entitlements. We went after all of them, whether it was Medicare or Medicaid or farm price supports, and we got savings. We achieved about $250 billion in savings. We also raised taxes, about $250 billion as well. Got about a $500 billion package in deficit reduction over, I guess, about 5 years. At the same time, Clinton also prioritized investments. Investments in research, investments in education, investments in
infrastructure.
In infrastructure and other areas. And I think that's the way you should do it. I mean, the problem now is the Congress isn't even beginning to address the issue of the debt or the deficit. And so they're all kind of, you know, running around trying to come up with simple answers that don't really address, you know, the fundamentals in our economy and what needs to be done. Alan?
Well, there's sure a reason for that, too. If you're a Democrat and you're talking about entitlement reform, you'll be visited in the evening hours by the AARP and the AFL-CIO telling you that, by the way, we have a primary opponent for you. You didn't know that, but the way you're talking, you're off the rail, pal, and we're going to have a guy run against you. Now, if you're Republican, you'll be visited by Grover Norquist in his white robes, and the Club for Growth will come to you and say, you know, you're babbling. You were talking about revenue or taxes, and you know that's a sin here, and so you are going to have a primary opponent. Well, what do you think they do? They worship the God of re-election, and they're going to say, "Well, I had a vision there for a while, but it passed." But that's That's your country right now. These people are in a safe district. They have pleased their base so beautifully that you couldn't beat them. And that's something Erskine and I really, really saw all over the United States, a tremendous power of the groups to wipe out anything that isn't part of the doctrine. And boy, the doctrine is with Republicans is revenue and taxes is a sin, and with the Dems it's don't touch anything with entitlements for Social Security. And you can't get there without that.
Bob? We're suffering a little bit from a kind of collective amnesia in this discussion, because between 1946 and 1981, we had the formula. We invested in education, we invested in infrastructure, we invested in basic R&D. We had a tax system that really, between 46 and 81, the top marginal tax rate was never below 70%. The effective tax rate, after all the deductions and so on, was about 52% on the top. And we got control over our deficits, we invested in young people, we had enormous economic growth. We had faster economic growth per year between 46 and 81 than we have subsequently, even with those high taxes. We knew how to do it, and we had labor unions, as I said before. The question to me is why we lost the formula. It's not, do we emulate the Germans or the Swedish or somebody else? Why did we lose, very suddenly, a formula that really did bring massive, widespread prosperity?
Why did we?
Well, I think it has to do with politics. I mean, I think there were political decisions made starting in the late 70s and all the way through the 80s and early 90s by Republicans and by Democrats to cut back on the investments that Christie is talking about, to change the tax code, to make it harder to unionize in many respects, to not provide the opportunities that we provided. Public higher education, something that I am now embedded in. I mean, the University of California in the 1960s, tuition and fees were what? Almost zero. Now they are, for many families, almost unaffordable. So if we actually dissect what we were doing right then and why we lost our way, I think we can have a much more effective discussion and a more affirmative discussion. This does work. You're right, Leon. And let me just say, while I have the floor, Leon Panetta, I want to brag a little bit about you, Leon, because I've known public servants who are very good. I've known public servants who are excellent, and I've known excellent public servants who actually take on the jobs that nobody in their right mind would ever take on. And Leon is all three. And Leon, you were there over this transition period. I mean, you worked in the Nixon administration, you worked in the Clinton administration, you saw a lot of these changes.
Yeah, no, I think the thing that has been the most frustrating for me is watching the dysfunction in Washington. Alan and I kind of shared that. If you have a dysfunctional Washington in which, you know, the president and the Congress, for whatever reason, can't work together, and Democrats and Republicans can't work together, then the reality is they're unable, for whatever reason, to address issues as they are today. They can't address the key economic issues facing this country. They can't come up with a budget deal. They can't deal with immigration reform. They can't come up with a comprehensive energy policy. They can't do infrastructure funding. They can't do tax reform. So all of the fundamental issues that are key to trying to deal with our economy, the dysfunction in Washington is preventing us from finding those answers. So I don't know, you know, what will it take? Because the next president of the United States, be it Republican or Democrat, that president, biggest challenge facing that president is how do you get this country to govern itself again? And I don't know, you know, how that will work. I think you mentioned money and politics. Money and politics is a big part of the problem.
I think the next president, whoever she is going to have to deal with the reality that we have more money in politics now than ever before, and a lot of it is coming from the same place where a lot of the wealth and income in this country has gone to.
You know, the thing that I remember, when you get into Social Security, don't forget, that's the biggest expenditure of the government. I know all the arguments. I put in it from the beginning, and I want it all out. Well, if you're 83, and I am. I got all mine back years ago. Furthermore, I never put in over $874 a year all during the 18 years of my practice of law, and nobody else did either, self-employed. Finally went to $1,200, $1,500 a year, and you whine like, you know, oh my God. And then went to $2,003 and then $6,012. And when I left the Senate, the average guy was getting everything back they put in, plus 6%. We added that to it in the Danforth Carey Commission. And they were getting it all back in 4 years. Now, you can't tell anybody that, but I'll tell you what happened to me. In practicing law, I'd have clients come in, they'd say, Al, I got my Social, this is in the 70s, early 70s. I got my Social Security check, it went up 8%. I said, no kidding, that's great. Well, it is great. Next year they came in and said it went up 14. Don't forget what happened in those years. And it was done by people wanting to run for president. They knew if they could ease the quadrant out there of then would be 50 million people by saying, I was the guy that raised your Social Security benefit. Don't forget it was, and there were Democrats and Republicans playing that game. And it was unbelievable. These checks just kept coming in and bigger. And then, I don't know when it stopped, but then when they set the level saying it couldn't go up worse than any more than inflation. Inflation was at 1% once, and a guy got up of my party, running for president, said, I think it ought to go 2%, even though it violates our code. And boy, it went through there like a dose of salts. Now, that's the way this works. And I tell you, it is a cruel thing to have a system that was set up by a pretty smart guy named FDR, and it was that you retired at 65 and you died at 62. and now the age of mortality is 79 and you can retire at 62. Who is kidding who in this game? It's cruel to you young people out there. Cruel is the best word, because when I was a freshman at the University of Wyoming in 1950, there were 16 people paying into the system and one taking out. There are 3 people paying into the system now and one taking out, and in 5 years there will be 2 people paying in, 12 grand each, so some old coot can get out 25. And if you think there's class warfare, or difficulty, and the AARP accuses us of class warfare by bringing this up. I mean, this, just use your common sense, use math, just math.